One in five workers in the U.S. has signed a non-compete agreement. Companies use these contracts to protect their trade secrets, reduce employee turnover, and improve their business leverage. Detractors, though, say that non-competes decrease wages and are burdensome to workers. There is now increasing private litigation against non-competes. Some states are passing limits on their use, and federal labor and antitrust regulators are on the alert.
State bars on non-competes may only make such agreements unenforceable, whereas if the agreement violates the antitrust laws, it may result in very serious financial penalties.
That's Jim Lowe, a partner in Sidley's antitrust and competition practice.
We're seeing two unrelated areas of law come together, and so you're going to need the advice of your employment lawyers and your antitrust lawyers at the same time.
And that's Teresa Reuter, a partner in the firm's labor employment immigration practice. In today's podcast, we'll discuss how non-compete agreements are utilized and what employers should know to protect their businesses. From the international law firm Sidley Austin, this is the Sidley Podcast, where we tackle cutting-edge issues in the law and put them in perspective for business people today. I'm Sam Gandhi. Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Sidley Podcast, episode number 39. Terry, Jim, great to have you on the podcast today.
Pleasure to be here, Sam.
Sam, thanks so much.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul vetoed a bill last month that would have banned the use of non-compete agreements for all workers in her state. This was after business groups had warned such a measure would push jobs out of New York, according to the Wall Street Journal. Terry, give us your high-level take on this, and for those who haven't had ever to consider these agreements, what are they and how have they historically been received?
So let's start with just talking about what non-competes are. Employers use non-compete agreements to prevent employees from working for competitors when they're employed and for a period after their employment terminates. Now, these typically have been governed by state laws in whether the nature of the employment termination, whether as an employee I leave the employer as an employer you fire me, whether that affects whether the non-compete is enforceable, really depends on state law. But frequently, no matter how you leave the relationship, you're prevented from going to a competitor. These types of provisions are also frequently paired with other types of provisions that protect companies and employers' confidential information and other business investments. And those types of provisions are non-use, non-disclosure of confidential information clauses, and then provisions that prevent employees from soliciting other employees of the company, customers, or potential customers. Non-competes historically have been disfavored because, of course, contract law is supposed to support a robust business environment in which competition is encouraged. So all non-competes must have an endpoint after employment. And depending on who the employee is, what work they did for a company, this could be as short as 3 months after employment, or in some cases up to 2 years or longer. And it's all fact specific. Now, thinking back a little bit, non-competes have really proliferated in recent years. Right now, about 20% of U.S. workers are bound by non-compete clauses in employment agreements, and 98%, so the vast majority of private employers, require executives and managers to sign non-compete agreements as a condition of employment. And this is all according to the U.S. Government Office of Accountability. With this proliferation, governments have responded in kind. So about half the nation's states have enacted legislation limiting non-compete clauses in some form. In some states, like Minnesota and California, among others, have banned them altogether. So they are not permitted for those folks that are based in Silicon Valley. California has had this restriction in place for more than a century, and it frequently holds itself out there as an example of how businesses can thrive even in the absence of these employment-based non-competes. Employers counter these arguments and say, we need them to protect our legitimate business investments and our interests. So the New York ban, for example, that you just mentioned that was vetoed by the governor, was opposed by large banks and corporations that rely heavily on non-competes to prevent top and frequently highly paid employees from unfairly competing in the marketplace. And that would mean taking strategies and know-how to direct competitors and using them immediately. Now, industry groups such as the Business Council of New York State also oppose broad restrictions on non-competes, and they argue that companies generally use them for legitimate reasons and that the courts already set limits on when and how the contracts can be enforced. And we see that a lot. Every time we talk to employers about non-compete enforcement, we have to say it's not a guarantee on enforceability. Critics, of course, counter all of these arguments, and they say non-competes prevent the free movement of labor, which is bad for businesses and employees, and place an unfair burden on workers, including those who work low-waged and low-skilled jobs. Now, supporters of the New York proposal said it would spur innovation and help this state compete with California for talent and new startups, and that's particularly in the tech sector. So you have a variety of opinions on whether New York's proposal was good or bad for business.
Terry, let me clarify one question for you. When you talk about non-competes that are being banned, you're talking about non-competes that even during the non-competition period, the employee is being paid, right, to not compete? Or is it any type of non-compete?
Any type of non-compete. So the employee would not necessarily be entitled to severance or other payment during that period. So it's basically saying you have a skill set and know-how and you cannot go to a direct competitor and use that skill set and know-how in your field for some period. And if you don't have the opportunity to work in another field, you might not have pay during that time.
Jim, what do you make of that? From the employer's perspective, what are your thoughts in terms of the case against these agreements?
For many companies, non-competes are the easiest way to reduce the risk that employees will leave and take trade secrets or customers or competitively sensitive information to a direct competitor. So without non-competes for employees who have access to that sort of sensitive information or customer relationships, employers will have more limited ways to prevent competitive harm to them or to their information. And non-disclosure agreements and perhaps limited cooling off periods may still be available, though there are some states that limit even those. But those are more difficult to enforce and may not be as effective. The proposed changes, and there are going to be more of them, the New York law has been vetoed for now, but almost certainly is going to pass in a different form later this year, will require employers and employment lawyers like Terry to be creative in developing ways of protecting the legitimate issues that non-competes were designed for.
And so, Terry, on a practical level, how do those agreements actually work? If I'm an employer, how does that actually relate to my business?
It's very business and industry specific, but generally speaking, what you'll see is at the start of employment or upon promotion or opportunity to participate in an incentive program, the employee will be asked to sign an agreement that will contain a non-compete provision. Now, I mentioned earlier, there are also other types of provisions that frequently are paired, the non-solicitation, non-disclosure, and those also will be in there and are intended to protect the same type of information and business investment. Depending on employer's practice, where it's located, where the employee is located, and many other factors, once an employee signs on to this agreement that contains non-compete and maybe these other provisions, that employee will be subject to those provisions. And it could be the case that they might not really affect the employee for many years until that employee terminates. Now, across all industries, these agreements are frequently used with folks who have significant contact with customers and other major sources of revenue for the business. The classic example is sales employees. So sales employees will frequently be prohibited from going to a direct competitor. You can't sell widgets at ABC Corp if you were used to be employed by Acme Corp for a year. And that would typically apply in the same territory as they sold before. So if I had a series of states that I covered before, it would typically cover that state. And the idea is that I'm going to have a competitive advantage working with my prior employer's products, data, pricing lists, etc., if I go to a direct competitor and do the same exact thing. Now, in other cases, it's less clear whether businesses are going to reap great protection from non-competes. And that's when businesses have all employees or lower level or lower paid employees who are less likely to leverage their skill, knowledge, any confidential information they had access to in a way that will really offer a competitive advantage to their new employer. And what we're seeing, you know, what New York was saying and some groups that were in favor, for example, of the New York proposal is it's unfair to require or allow those folks to be subject to non-competes. Given this question of what's fair, whether employees are fairly prevented from going to a direct competitor, that's where the regulators are stepping in to try to basically draw boundaries and say, here's what we think is fair, here's what we think isn't. So this scrutiny that we're going to talk about and that Jim's going to talk about too from this antitrust angle is not going away. It is here with us to stay. There's a general consensus that the expansion of the use of non-competes with lower level and lower paid employees is what's prompting this movement in state legislators to step up and this federal proposal that Jim's going to talk about. And New York's governor actually talked about that in terms of trying to find a compromise for some New York legislation. What happens when governments step in is frequently they're going farther than businesses would like in trying to protect workers. And so you'll see when we talk about our federal proposal, it's a complete ban. And what was proposed in New York also was a complete ban.
Jim, to Terry's last point, how's enforcement factored into the arena of these non-compete agreements? What's the government looking at doing?
Historically, restrictions on employee movement, be they non-competes or agreements between employers not to solicit or hire each other's employees, have largely been a matter of employment and contract law in the area that Terry works in. A few states, as Terry mentioned, but most notably California, historically had strict limits on such agreements. But generally, they were viewed as enforceable, if not wildly unreasonable. And so that was the status quo for many, many years. However, that has started to change. Employment restrictions, including non-competes and non-solicits, started to be a focus of interest to the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice when it investigated an alleged no-hire agreement among West Coast tech firms in the early 2000s. That investigation resulted in DOJ bringing civil cases against a number of those firms in 2010. And following on from those cases, in 2016, DOJ and the Federal Trade Commission issued guidelines stating that certain types of no-hire, also known as no-poach agreements, would potentially be subject to criminal prosecution as effectively price-fixing agreements. In the last 3 years, DOJ has brought a number of criminal no-poach cases, though they have so far been unsuccessful, resulting in either dismissal or in acquittals. Nonetheless, DOJ has stated that it will continue to bring them along with civil cases where appropriate, and we are aware of a number of grand juries that are open investigating these sorts of agreements. DOJ has also brought cases alleging wage fixing among employers, which again relates to employee movement and wage freedom. It's also important to note that to be subject to an allegation of an illegal agreement regarding wages or hiring under the antitrust laws, the firms involved do not need to compete downstream. They just need to compete for the same type of employees. For example, firms may need the same type of engineers, even though they use them to design very different downstream products, but they still compete for those engineers and therefore are considered competitors under the antitrust laws for purposes of the labor market. Both DOJ and the Federal Trade Commission and a number of state attorneys general also continue to focus on non-compete agreements, particularly those involving, as Terry said, lower wage employees, and both have challenged agreements and filed briefs in support of plaintiffs in some of the private cases challenging non-competes, non-solicits, and no-poach agreements. More recently, under the direction of President Biden, the Federal Trade Commission is exploring a national ban on companies requiring workers that require workers to sign the agreements. So in January of last year, the Federal Trade Commission issued a proposed rule to ban all non-compete agreements, regardless of type or level of employment. That has resulted in a deluge of comments on the proposed rules, and the FTC, after it digests those comments, is expected to vote later this year on a final version of its proposed nationwide ban. There is question as to the FTC's authority to issue such a rule, and the Chamber of Commerce and other business groups have said that the rule exceeds the agency's authority, and therefore, if they issue a rule, it is likely to face legal challenges. It's also important to note that this is not limited to just enforcement by DOJ and the FTC. Both DOJ and FTC have entered into agreements with the Department of Labor and DOJ with the National Labor Relations Board to address all forms of employment restrictions. And the antitrust agency's new merger guidelines highlight that the impact of transactions on labor may be a factor in merger investigations and merger enforcement. Additionally, the General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board in May 2023 issued a memo asserting that employee non-competes violate the National Labor Relations Act, and she has separately asserted that customer non-solicit agreements may also violate the act. So there are a number of agencies involved here, Sam, and we expect that the focus at the federal level will continue and expand.
Let me ask you both, what does the federal government think of what a non-compete actually is? Is it any restriction on competing after you're terminated? Is there any kind of guidance that the government has issued in terms of what type of restriction would be permissible?
Well, I think just from the point of view of the FTC's rule as drafted currently is extraordinarily broad and would effectively stop all types of non-competes, regardless of their purpose or intent or their scope, from being enforceable. Again, whether that rule will survive is an open question at this point. But certainly that's the FTC's view. DOJ has not spoken as much on non-competes, so that's a little less clear what the scope of their concern is. And the NLRB's statement is relatively limited and is not sufficiently defined at this point to know if it reaches the scope of the FTC rule. But Terry, I don't know where the states are on all of this.
At the state level, generally speaking, we're seeing non-competes, so a prohibition on working for a competitor business, taking another position, as getting the most scrutiny. And then some states legislate on non-solicits, customer non-solicits, and to a lesser extent, employee non-solicits. And at times, they legislate on those, but provide a lower level of scrutiny and a greater level of variability as to what is permissible. And so I think you're going to continue to see that tiered approach where the prohibition on working for a competitor, because you're preventing people potentially from earning a living during that time, is going to see the greatest scrutiny. And then the other types of provisions we talked about, these other types of restrictive covenants, are going to get a lesser level of scrutiny and be more permissible. That's where we see this going.
You're listening to the Sidley Podcast. We're speaking with Sidley partners Jim Lowe and Terry Reuter about the parameters of non-compete agreements, how they're implemented, and the regulatory considerations for businesses. So last year, the FTC and the Department of Labor signed what is called an MOU, or a Memorandum of Understanding, to join forces to combat anti-competitive practices in labor markets. And some contend those agencies may use this joint effort to bolster their enforcement by identifying additional cases for each agency to pursue. And so, Terry, there's obviously a lot of legal overlap between antitrust issues and labor and employment issues. What should businesses know about this important intersection?
This is an area where we're seeing two previously more or less unrelated areas of law come together. And so you're going to continue to need the advice of your employment lawyers and your antitrust lawyers at the same time and aligned on the same principles. So this is an area where Jim and I have really partnered on more than we have in the past as regulation and scrutiny has been stronger. Jim mentioned earlier that more than half of states impose restrictions of some kind on restrictive covenants and non-competes, and we're seeing those more AGs use their power to quell the enforcement and our use of no hire and non-competition agreements under state antitrust and state employment laws. Where we see these issues come up, where both of our guidance is frequently needed, is in corporate transactions, and in particularly carve-outs. So where businesses are going to either buy a part of another business or they're going to sell off a portion of their business. And frequently in that transaction document, there will be an agreement among the parties that said, okay, you're not going to solicit certain groups of my employees, and I'm not going to solicit certain groups of your employees. And inevitably, in those contracts, there's questions about whether the non-solicitation applies, whether it's enforceable, whether a no hire would be enforceable. And the reason we see that in carve-outs more than just in a full sale of a business is that when you're doing a carve-out, you're splitting off employees and you're making a decision about whether they are in scope to the carve-out business or out of scope. And there's always a little bit of ambiguity there. When looking at those contractual provisions, they often have tail periods of 18 months or 2 years. And so Jim and I frequently will be on a deal team, and then it'll come back 18 months later and we'll have to revisit with the parties what was intended, what happened here. And so you're really going to want your antitrust and employment team on those matters and thinking about those issues with you.
Jim, I want to follow up with you on this. Your thoughts on the synergy between antitrust and employment from the antitrust perspective?
You know, Sam, I've been an antitrust lawyer for more than 30 years, and it's only in the last 5 or 6 years that I've interacted with employment lawyers, including Terry. It just wasn't a factor for a long period of time in antitrust. Historically, HR professionals needed only to speak with labor and employment lawyers. And then, as Terry said, that's really changed. HR professionals and executives and companies generally, and certainly in-house counsel, need to be conscious that agreements with employees and with other employers that restrict employees that may have been acceptable in the past may now create both employment law and antitrust risk. The latter of which can be exceedingly costly to the company, since antitrust litigation involves extensive discovery and expert testimony and can result in treble damages where there's an unfavorable verdict. The FTC's foray into non-competes in the last year highlights how labor is now a focus of competition and consumer protection law. Incidentally, this is true not only in the U.S., but also in Europe and the U.K. as well. So this is not a solely U.S. phenomenon. Both enforcers at the EC level and in the U.K. have indicated an interest in these sorts of labor issues. So HR professionals and their in-house counsel need to be conscious that restrictions on employees that might have passed muster under their relevant state law currently may run afoul of federal law, and understand the implications of all potential legal risks and their consequences. For example, state bars on non-competes may only make such agreements unenforceable, whereas if the agreement violates the antitrust laws, it may result in very serious financial penalties for the company.
Sam, I'd like to add one more thing. On the topic of penalties, California also is getting in the business of penalizing companies who use illegal non-competes. So we're seeing that at the federal and also state level.
As we wrap up the podcast, this question's for both of you, which is, what's on the minds of your clients and what are the issues on these types of agreements are they posing to you?
I would say two issues dominate clients' questions on non-competes right now. The first regards, how do I manage a restrictive covenant agreement when my employees are geographically dispersed? This question has been more important since the pandemic, and generally speaking, the expansion of remote work, including for smaller businesses and startups. So it used to be the case that we would see those businesses centered on one or two locations, but now we're seeing employers take advantage of the national labor pool and are hiring anywhere. And that means they could be subject to the state laws of dozens of states rather than one or two. And they want to know, can I fit all of these provisions in one form and use it for everyone, all my employees? Do I need to have different state-specific forms? And the answer to those questions is going to depend heavily on the sophistication of your back office business functions, your legal and HR department, how many employees you have, who you want to have non-competes. So there's lots of questions about developing a system that works for your business and is bespoke to your business.
So can I interrupt you for a second? Technically, could an employee kind of turn that back on you, saying that in fact, given that this is national, this actually applies in states like California and other places in which it's banned, and so therefore it's banned?
Well, if the FTC's rule comes into play, yes, this will be a whole new ball game. And Jim and I will be very busy talking to companies about reworking their agreements. But until the rule becomes final, and frankly, we do expect it to be subject to legal challenges depending on what it says. Right now, we're still in the patchwork of state-driven regulations on non-competes. And that's a real headache for employers, no doubt. Although many would say, I'd much rather deal with the patchwork than deal with the complete ban. The other issue we talk about regularly is getting ahead of that ban and whether we can do anything to anticipate what will happen. It's really tough because the complete ban was a little bit farther than I think folks thought the FTC would go. And I think just like what happened in New York, what we talked about in the beginning, there's a sense that non-competes are particularly useful for highly paid folks who have really sensitive and competitively advantageous information. And so I think there's an expectation that at least in some locations, they'll continue to be permissible. But it's all subject to what the FTC does. So we'll have to wait and see.
Jim, to sum up with you, what are your clients telling you from the antitrust standpoint?
As Terry said, we're seeing this a lot in transactions and in two respects. One of which is the question of where a company wants to have limitations on, for example, employee movement after a transaction, or whether they want to enforce existing employee agreements. And we do a lot of advising on what is likely enforceable and acceptable under both employment and antitrust law. So we see that a lot. Increasingly, these questions are arising in due diligence in transactions as well, because sophisticated buyers want to make sure they're not buying themselves liability if the target is a participant in agreements that may prove to be illegal either now or in the future. And so we're asking a lot of due diligence questions about those topics. We're also seeing this in compliance training. Labor markets, as we've said, are increasingly the focus of antitrust, and companies now need to include their HR professionals in their antitrust compliance training that they should be doing in any event. And they need to train those professionals on how to identify conduct that could create an antitrust risk. Also, companies need to see if they, in fact, have agreements that could run afoul of the law, not just in non-compete agreements, as Terry talked about in preparing for the potential FTC rule, but also non-solicit and no-poach agreements with other employers. And they need to do some asking around and auditing to see if those agreements exist, and we've been involved in some of those efforts as well. It's also important to remember in this context that under the antitrust laws, the definition of an agreement is very broad. It can include literally a wink or a nod or a note on a napkin at a dinner, and also can include what we might call gentlemen's agreements between executives. Those sorts of agreements have been the basis of some of these criminal no-poach agreements that DOJ has brought so far. And no hire, no solicit, non-competes all create both enforcement risk and private litigation risk. And so companies really need to take steps through compliance training and auditing to limit those risks. And if they discover that there are parties to agreements that may cause trouble, to work quickly to limit that risk, either by restructuring agreements or by eliminating them entirely. Those are the sorts of things on the antitrust side that we're seeing. And as Terry said, we work very closely with her and her colleagues, particularly on the transactional side, to make sure we've covered all angles as those issues arise.
We've been speaking with Sidley thought leaders Jim Lowe and Terry Reuter about the antitrust matters that often figure in employment law and how they're advising clients in these areas. Jim, Terry, it's been a great look at the landscape regarding non-compete agreements. Thanks for sharing your insights on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Sam.
You've been listening to the Sidley Podcast. I'm Sam Gandhi. Our executive producer is John Metaxas, and our managing editor is Karen Tucker. Listen to more episodes at sidley.com/sidleypodcast and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.